Welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, joined by Tom Fornelli, and this is the Week 4 Rewind. Tom, welcome back. What did you think about all of the rain and all of the blowouts and all of the injuries?
It was an ugly Saturday of college football, and one that we're complaining about now, and we were complaining about it as it was happening, but come May, when we're stuck watching baseball on Saturday, a sport I enjoy very much, to be honest with you, but still, I would rather have a bad day of college football than a good day of baseball.
There you go. Tom, I'm a little caught off guard by you being the glass half full man in this, but I will take it. I agree with
I've
you.
I've turned over a new leaf, Chip. My fantasy teams are winning. Things are going great, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, there was a lot to take away from the weekend, so that's what we will do. As we are maybe not necessarily seeing the most aesthetically pleasing football on the screen, in the stadiums, wherever you were this weekend, we did at least get a better understanding of some of these teams and how they stack up in their own conferences. And so I want to start out with Florida and Tennessee just really making the SEC East look like it's going to be a two-team race between Georgia and South Carolina. Jeff Driskel out for the rest of the year, broken leg. And while Murphy comes in at the quarterback position, adds a little bit on the ground, you're still really worried about where the Florida's offense is. Do you think that the Gators' D can hold them in and they could get a win over Georgia or South Carolina?
No. This game reminded me of last year's Florida-Georgia game, because it was ugly.
Oh, yeah. Just seven turnovers just all the way through.
Nine turnovers.
Yeah.
You're giving them too much credit. Tennessee nearly had seven on its own. But no, Tyler Murphy came on, and I guess he played all right. He's definitely a good, you know, he was able to get some grounds with his legs, and he was able to move the ball that way, but didn't really seem to be much of a threat throwing the ball. And I mean, I know that what Florida does is pretty much based on its defense, and I think their defense, when they play South Carolina and they play Georgia, will do an effective job of slowing them down, but at the end of the day, you still have to score more points. And I don't see this Gator team being a team that you can count on to do that. So, no, I think it's Georgia and South Carolina at this point.
Another division race that sort of stood out, Michigan. You know, I'm up and down on Michigan because they beat Notre Dame and they look kind of good in doing so. Devin Gardner has a pretty good performance, and we start to put some of the blame on Notre Dame's secondary, or we try and figure out what was up. But we figure the Gardner to Gallon connection, this Michigan offense is going to be able to be great. Then you have last week against Akron. Then all of a sudden we've got more turnovers this week against UConn. UConn has a shot to win this game. They end up losing 24-21 due to a really impressive one-armed interception. Do you think Michigan is still a team that's prepared to go into the Big Ten and win, let's say, six conference games?
If they clean some things up, because, I mean, this is a team that, you're right, for the last 2 weeks has looked like hot ass. And
yeah,
it's been because they are turning the ball over at a very alarming rate. There were four turnovers yesterday. Devin Gardner has thrown eight interceptions, he's thrown eight interceptions this season through, you know, four games. He's thrown seven touchdowns. Granted, he's also run for five more, but still, anytime you have more interceptions than touchdown passes as a quarterback, that's not a good thing. I mean, Denard Robinson was a better, you know, better at taking care of the ball.
Yeah, I saw those stats start to float around a little bit yesterday, where it's like when Denard was being heavily criticized, his numbers were about at or better than what Gardner has through four games this season.
Yeah, and that was supposed to be the thing that changed going from Robinson to Gardner. It was supposed to be able to, you know, better care of the ball, less arm punts. And there might be, you know, less arm punts, but Devin Gardner has a problem holding on to the ball when he's running. He carries it out, you know, like a foot away from his body, which is causing problems. And right now, Michigan's got, on the season, they've got a turnover margin of -5, which has them tied for 117th in the nation, which isn't good. And I feel like Michigan's still a talented team, and it's still one of the more talented teams in the Big Ten. But if they don't start taking care of the football, it's going to catch up to them at some point. They're lucky that they were playing UConn and Akron the last 2 weeks, because if they were playing two teams that, you know, had any semblance of decency, they've lost the last 2 weeks.
Well, one team that they do have is Michigan State, and that defense, you know, once again, Michigan State's defense, they have got to be the most frustrated unit in the entire country right now, because at the beginning of the season, they were scoring the touchdowns for the Spartans, and now they really did almost everything they could, but they end up falling short to Notre Dame. First of all, where's Notre Dame at right now? Because they've about to get into sort of the meat as the rest of the teams go into their own conference play. Notre Dame sort of goes through the gauntlet, and we've got Norman, we got Oklahoma coming up pretty soon. Yep. Where do you think they're at right now, and how do you sort of set your expectations for the rest of the season?
I don't think you could take anything you see from their offense yesterday to heart, because they were facing that really good defense. But I mean, the Irish offense averaged 3.3 yards per play yesterday and still somehow managed to win thanks to its pass interference attack. But no, I mean, when you look at that schedule, I mean, they've still got, like you said, they've got Oklahoma next. They've still got Stanford coming. This is a team that's looking more and more like an 8-4 squad than it is, you know, last year's 12-0 team. And it's like we've talked about before. I mean, Tommy Rees isn't a terrible quarterback, but Tommy Rees, at the same time, he doesn't really provide the options that Everett Golson did last year on this offense, that, you know, the dual threat that kind of made the offense more dynamic and gave it more options. Rees is a good player, but he's not great. He's Tommy Rees. I think that's what we've used it before. Tommy Rees is Tommy Rees. He's not horrible, but he's not great. So I feel like the defense played well yesterday, but again, I don't know if we could take that seriously considering the horrible offense it was facing. But unless the defense improves a lot from what we saw in recent weeks before yesterday, this is a team to me that it screams 8-4.
Yeah, I'm with you right there. Just not a lot of consistency where I think that with all of the incredibly solid, a lot of these opponents are pretty much all conference title contenders. At least division title contenders.
Yeah, I mean, you can't knock Notre Dame's schedule. They're not, you know, they're not taking it easy. We mentioned Oklahoma. It's Oklahoma, Arizona State, USC, then a bad Air Force team, then Navy, then Pitt, who's, you know, been decent, and then BYU and Stanford. It's not going to get any easier.
Wisconsin absolutely rolled Purdue, and I'm beginning to think that there is no reason for us to have last year, the 6-6, remember, it was a rough start, stronger finish on their way to being able to knock off Nebraska, the Big Ten title game, then get to the Rose Bowl. I'm beginning to think that the expectation for this Wisconsin team, the way that they've been running the ball with Melvin Gordon and James White, they averaged 8 yards a carry as a team against Purdue on the way to 388 team rushing yards. I mean, this is absolutely a Big Ten title team with the way they've been playing, and they got jobbed in the Arizona State game. But in that Arizona State game, I think the defense did a great job of showing that they would be able to defend, you know, the Northwesterns, or, you know, if they get matched up, when they get matched up against Ohio State, that they'll be able to handle some of those spread concepts. I like these guys to possibly steal the Big Ten.
Yeah, and when you look at this team, I mean, I don't know if they even need to ever throw the ball. I think they could just sit back and run on every play and they'd be just fine. And you look at, because Melvin Gordon, if you think about all the great running backs that Wisconsin's had, you know, it's had Ron Dane, who won a Heisman, set college records, and, you know, Monte Ball was fantastic. I think Melvin Gordon may be the best Wisconsin running back we've seen. And it's not because, you know, he's got the size to go in between the tackles, but he has speed. He has another gear that I haven't seen from a Wisconsin running back where he's running away from defensive backs, whereas the other guys you would see get caught from behind. Nobody's going to catch Melvin Gordon. And he's had a fantastic start to the season. And he's also overshadowed James White, who's actually a pretty good running back himself. It's just he's not as insane as Melvin Gordon is. So I feel like White gets overshadowed because of it. But this is an offense that's fantastic. It's running the ball. I mean, this week, they only had two guys go over 100 yards. And that's actually a step back because they've been having three running backs over 100 yards each of the first 3 weeks. But what's going to decide, you know, this week's game, they're going to Columbus to face Ohio State this week. And it's a huge game because Wisconsin really is, from what I've seen in the first month of the year, is really the only threat to Ohio State in the leaders division. So if Ohio State's not going to win the division, it will be because Wisconsin beats them this week. If the Badgers don't beat Ohio State, it's going to be really tough for them to overcome it, just because I don't know who else in the Big Ten is really capable of knocking off Ohio State at this point.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about some style points since we were talking about running up the score. As Alabama, Texas A&M puts up 42 on that Alabama defense. Texas A&M, top 10 team, no reason to think they are necessarily a step down, but there was a little bit of a letdown against Colorado State. Alabama really struggled on third down on offense. Allowed Colorado State to sort of hang around in the game, eventually pulling away late. Do you think that the Alabama Oregon distance, the distance between those two teams, as far as the way the general college football public or the voting the voters of the AP poll or the coaches poll, do you think that gap is shrinking, and do you think it is just a matter of style points?
Yeah, I think it's. I think Oregon crept ever closer to Alabama in the coaches poll. I can't remember. It was one of the two polls where Oregon crept closer on a bye week, it had to be because of the way, Alabama didn't destroy Colorado State. But at the same time, I'm not really surprised Alabama didn't destroy Colorado State, because as you mentioned, there's the letdown factor from last week's game. And also Jim McElwain is Colorado State's head coach, who, used to be Alabama's offensive coordinator. And knowing Nick Saban, I'm sitting there thinking, Saban's not going to try to embarrass his former offensive coordinator. So I don't know if Alabama really, tried anything special, if it went pretty straightforward and vanilla in this game. And, it's still won by 25 points against a Colorado State team that's not terrible. It's not great, but it's not a terrible team.
Right. It's not a lower division team. This is a pretty, middle of the Mountain West type team.
Yeah. But as far as the gap between Alabama and Oregon, I think it's a lot closer than the polls would have you believe, and I don't think it's style points that separates them as much as it's just, Alabama's won three of the last four national titles, so until they get knocked off, nobody's going to put Oregon above them, or at least most people aren't. But I would think that if Alabama and Oregon played right now, I don't know who would win, but I think a lot of people might be surprised by how many points Oregon put up.
Well, the distance between Alabama and Oregon wasn't as interesting as the idea. I think it was suggested that I think we might have mentioned it on the Expert Picks podcast, that Ohio State getting dropped after a win started raising that sort of general question of, well, do you need to go out there and just like beat the tar out of people just in order to prove that you deserve that high ranking or that high number? Because by that theory, Clemson probably should have dropped too.
Yeah, no, I can't tell you how everybody, like AP voters are going to vote or coaches are going to vote, but I do think that for a lot of them, a lot of people are just looking at the score. When they're filling out that ballot on Saturday night, they're just looking at scores of games they didn't see because they're either working the game or they're coaching a game. So it's like they see, they only won by 20 and this team won by 70, where really the game could have been, as far as the actual games are concerned, both games could have pretty much been over by the end of the first quarter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there is, if you're destroying teams, I think it's going to help in your perceptions from the pollsters. I don't know that it should, though.
Staying right there in the SEC, we had LSU gets up to a 21-0 halftime lead. They were playing in the middle of a monsoon. The students pretty much leave, and Auburn starts pushing. LSU answers. I am initially a little bit concerned about how hard I was riding the LSU train heading into this game, but I'm willing to chalk it all up to the weather and the weird conditions, maybe even giving some credit to Auburn and Nick Marshall. What about you?
I think more credit goes to Auburn here. I don't think LSU played bad. They had the 21-0 lead at halftime, and then they built it up to a 21-point lead again in the third quarter, and then they built it up to a 21-point lead again in the fourth quarter. So it's not like this game was ever actually in doubt. What impressed me more than anything was that Auburn didn't quit.
Yeah.
Even though the game was over, Auburn was playing like it still had a chance to win. And I think if you're an Auburn fan, and I think we know one of those, I think if you're an Auburn fan, this is one of those things where you see this game and you actually, you got beat by 14, but you got beat by 14 by a really good team on the road, and your team fought. And compared to what we've seen the last few years of what happened with the Tigers or Auburn Tigers, I think it's a win you feel, or a loss you feel good about. Whereas LSU, I think it's a win you feel good about as well, because they didn't play bad. I mean, they didn't have the same game, but like you mentioned, it's terrible weather, which is going to have an impact. But the Tigers never, you know, they were never really in depth. It was never really in jeopardy here.
Yeah, our friend, the Auburn fan, I think he said on Twitter, this was, quote, real legitimate progress.
War damn Eagle.
Georgia, North Texas. North Texas gets 2 touchdowns in the kicking game. Georgia otherwise does a pretty good job of taking care of business against Dan McCarney's squad. We are looking ahead to Georgia LSU. Those two teams each, I mean, very big game, because Georgia cannot afford that loss in order to allow the SEC East race to open up. LSU knows that they can't take it if they want to be able to beat Alabama to challenge for the West. What's your initial read on that game, especially coming out of two pretty decided wins in week 4?
Actually, if I could backtrack for 1 second, going back to what we were talking about with the polls a minute ago, this is one of those games where if the pollster just looks at the final score and sees Georgia won by 24, and it's like, okay, and they don't know what really happened.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was 21-21 in the third quarter. But as for next week's game, which, you know, next week's schedule is better than this week's, but it's really not, there's not a ton of marquee games. And this, the Georgia-LSU game is far and away the best game on the schedule. And, yeah, it's a huge game for both teams. And I don't know which way I'm leaning just yet. I haven't really looked at anything, but it's huge for both. Georgia's head of offense has been fantastic. Its defense is still suspect, even though they didn't. Not all 21 points are on the Georgia defense from yesterday. At LSU's, it's just Georgia can't. Neither team can afford to lose, and I think that's what makes it a great game, because it's two good teams who can't afford to lose.
Clemson struggle with NC State in my top 25 rankings. I know I dropped them below. I believe LSU and somebody else. I dropped Clemson below Ohio State, Stanford, and LSU to number 6 in my top 25. The things that I saw in Raleigh was just some of the little bits of letdown, the little bits of not being able to handle or make the right read on something. Pete Thomas came out. He started doing a lot of planned quarterback draws, quarterback runs, and they really sort of got fooled by it for a little bit. So just, you know, a little chink in the armor just made me just sort of drop them a little bit in confidence. And did you have any other takeaway from that?
No, I mean, on the road in a short week, sometimes things are going to happen where they don't, you know, look nearly as impressive. And they did get off to a somewhat of a slow start, but I think they finished well. And I think what's impressive to me about this game is that even on an off night for Taj Boyd, he still put together a pretty nice stat line. I mean, he completed 65% of his passes for 245 yards. He had 3 touchdowns, didn't turn the ball over, and that's an off night.
Yeah, the key for Boyd was he was 9 for 11 in the second half, and that was just like when Clemson needed to put the game away, he was able to complete passes and keep things moving.
Yeah, and NC State was able to move the ball in Clemson as well, but every team's always been able to move the ball in Clemson. So it's like when I see teams scoring points against the Tigers, and NC State only had 14. They had nearly 400 yards of offense, but they only scored 2 touchdowns. So I feel like I don't take too much away from it. Yeah, it could be a bit of a concern, but like I said, short week on the road, stranger things are going to happen.
Stanford comes out and in the first half just absolutely dictates everything against Arizona State. This was the only matchup between ranked teams. And David Shaw even said afterwards, he said, we played two great quarters, one solid quarter, and one really bad quarter. And it was allowing 3 Arizona State touchdowns in that fourth quarter as they were able to come back and at least threaten somewhat. But Stanford, to me, showed their best and their worst in this game. In the San Jose State, in the Army victories, there were times where Stanford was a little bit mediocre, had some trouble taking care of the ball. It didn't quite look like the Stanford sort of juggernaut power team that we got to know last year. But then that's exactly what we saw in the first half against Arizona State. I am very encouraged by what I saw in the first half. Not going to really hate on them for the fourth quarter since it was the conference opener, but certainly a concern because you do have to play 4 quarters in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of three quarters, Stanford was up 39-7, and they took their foot off the gas in the fourth, and, you know, they nearly got caught because of it. So I'm not too concerned about it. I do think, you know, it's natural. If you're up 32 points going into the fourth quarter, you're not going to be as tense. Things are going to ease up. The game is in hand, and Arizona State, being the kind of quick strike offense it is, they were able to put three touchdowns on the board really quick. But once things got serious, it ended again. Stanford, okay, let's put an end to this. They had a nice, you know, nice drive to chew some clock off and get the field goal to put it back to a two-touchdown game. So it wasn't the perfect game that you'd want to see from Stanford and a team that's ranked as highly. But it's not like Arizona State sucks, and I wouldn't take too much from it.
USC holds off Utah State, and we're very, very lucky to do so. The Trojans offense 0-for-8 on third down throughout the second half, when all they needed to do was try and maintain that lead, and they did the worst thing possible, which is they continued to put the ball into Chucky Keaton's hands. But props to Clancy Pendergrast and that fantastic Trojans defense. They were able to hold on for the victory. How far can USC ride the defense in the Pac-12 before, like where, at what point is the offensive deficiency? Obviously, we saw it against Washington State, but at what point can they not rely on their defense? What matchups are going to really give them problems?
UCLA will be a huge problem, I would think, because even if you slow down UCLA, that's a very good pass or very good offense, and they're still going to get to about 24, 30 points on you, even if you're slowing them down, because it's just that good. Oregon's, does USC play Oregon this year, actually? Let me check.
No, I don't think so.
No, so they don't have to worry about Oregon. Stanford, I think Stanford is actually a good matchup for them, because that's the kind of attack that they can slow down. I think that's pretty decent. But when it comes to the game against UCLA to finish the year, comes to Arizona in a couple weeks, I think that's a tough one. They've got Arizona State on the road. I think the next two games for the Trojans are going to give us a really good idea of how good this defense has been. But the defense has been phenomenal through the first four games. And I feel like it's one of those things where we're so focused on the struggles of the USC offense that nobody has really been talking about how quickly this defense turned around, because it's a top 10 defense in just about every major defensive category so far this year. And it's pretty damn good.
Morgan Breslin, Leonard Williams, just a lot of players along that sort of front seven, that sort of 3-4-5-2 alignment that they use. It's just they're nasty. Dudes you're going to see playing in the NFL soon.
Yeah, it's talent. They've got like an SEC quality front seven.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sua Cravens in the defensive backfield ain't too shabby either. He's just a freshman.
No. So this is a team, you know, it's that – that defense is going to carry this team, and if the offense gets going, if they get anything out of that offense, this is a team that could, you know, rally. It could finish very strong. It's probably save Kiffin's life or job.
Are you crushing on? I'm crushing on the USC's defense, but sounds like you're on
bandwagon
too. Yeah, all right. I'm a big fan of USC's defense. Speaking of hot seat and saving jobs, Jonathan Gray breaks out. You know, I feel like we've been waiting on a big game like this, especially against Kansas State, a team that has traditionally been very good at stopping the run. Jonathan Gray comes out. Kansas State really does not get much help from the quarterback position, and Texas is able to win. Mac said after the loss to Ole Miss, this was going to be about winning the Big 12. Did you see a tremendous step forward for Texas, or was this just a matchup issue for the Wildcats?
I saw a step forward in that the defense played much better, you know, because that's been the real problem with the Longhorns. The defense has been getting gashed by teams that run the same kind of offense Kansas State does. And while the Wildcats did a lot of damage to the air, particularly with Tyler Lockett, who finished with 237 receiving yards, which, wow, good for him. But still, the Kansas State rushing attack averaged only 3 yards per carry. And when you consider what, you know, Ole Miss and BYU did to Texas in the previous 2 weeks, that's a huge step forward.
And John Hubert's good, too. That's a good running back.
Yeah, exactly. Hubert's good. I mean, Daniel Sams, the running quarterback, was, you know, their leading rusher. He had 48 yards and 8 carries, so he really wasn't that effective. So the Texas defense played well. They also got a lot of, you know, pressure on Jake Waters towards the end of the game. The pass rush was very good. They had 4 sacks. So I think it was a complete effort from the Longhorns on defense. Yes, they gave up those yards to Lockett, but that was it. And then on offense, I think it was nice to see David Ash playing well, but I think the biggest, the best sign for going forward is that after Ash left at halftime with what I'm guessing is a concussion, they called it a head injury, but considering what had been the case before, I'm guessing it was a reoccurrence.
Right.
The team played well with Case McCoy. Case McCoy he wasn't great. He only completed 5 of his 9 passes, but they've realized the bread and butter of that offense is turning around and handing it off. And Jonathan Gray, who had 140 yards and 2 touchdowns, Malcolm Brown had 40 yards and a touchdown. This is the formula that Texas needs to follow. It's going to be, feeding their running backs and getting the defense to stop people. And if the defense keeps playing like it did yesterday, I don't know that they're good enough to compete for a Big 12 title, but they might be good enough to get people off Mac's back.
Yeah, staying right there in the hot seat land, Bo Pelini's just horrible, horrible week at least ends with a victory, though things were a little bit tight there in the first quarter, but Nebraska pulls away. Taylor Martinez does not play with turf toe, and Amir Abdullah ends up having a career day on the ground. I didn't get to watch much of this game. Did you?
I didn't see too much. I mean, I was watching in the first quarter after South Dakota State. I found out it, was tied 14-14. I tuned in. And then quickly after that, Nebraska kind of took over. But I think the win is nice. But when you're looking at the statistics, South Dakota State still had 465 yards of offense. They did turn the ball over 3 times, which helped Nebraska tremendously. But the Jackrabbits also averaged 7 yards a play for the day. So
our concerns were about the Nebraska defense, and they're playing South Dakota freaking State, and we still have concerns, at least looking at the statistics. But again, I didn't want to pass judgment yet because I still need to watch the replay.
No, they tightened some things up, but there's still, obviously, you look at these numbers, and from what I saw, there's still some concern. And if the offense can score 60 points every week, there might not be much concern, but I don't know if Nebraska's quite out of the woods yet. I don't know if you can say a win over South Dakota State is all right, everything's okay, we're fine.
Maryland and West Virginia, two teams.
Terps!
Yeah, two teams going in two very different directions. Let us first start with West Virginia, where Dana Holgorsen said after the game that was about, quote, inept as we could be, and it really was a poor, poor, poor offensive performance by the Mountaineers. And it's so weird because as we pointed out sort of throughout Saturday, if you were following along with the Eye on College Football during game day, this is such a far cry from less than a year ago when Geno Smith and the Mountaineers were number 5 in the country. Smith was a Heisman front runner, and since then, the Mountaineers are 3-8 against FBS competition. This has just sort of been a slow unraveling. And I know you sort of brought this up. What, as we're starting to take a step back, we're starting to get further from the Orange Bowl. And what are you thinking is the future for West Virginia, particularly if this trajectory continues, because it's not going up?
Yeah, if you look at the man who Dana Holgorsen replaced, Bill Stewart, in 2008, things got started. His first season, things started off well. The Mountaineers went 9-4. In 2009, they went 9-4. In 2010, they went 9-4. And then he was fired. So he went, in his 3 years as head coach, he went 27-12 and got fired. Things started out well for Holgorsen. They went 10-3 and scored 70 points in the Orange Bowl. And oh my God, the Mountaineers are taking over the world. Last year, things started well. They stumbled to the finish line and finished 7-6. This year, they're 2-2 and just got shut out by Maryland 37-0. So if Bill Stewart can get fired after his third season when he's, going 9-4 every season, is Dana on the hot seat? I mean, would you be surprised at this point if West Virginia doesn't get things turned together that they decide to go in a different direction? Because while things started off really well when they had Geno Smith, Tavon Austin, they've been going down this year since. And when you look at how they finished last year with how they're starting this year, it's rolling downhill pretty fast. And I'm wondering if West Virginia might pull the trigger on something if it doesn't turn around.
I don't think I don't think anything happens immediately, but it is a question worth considering as, again, as we continue to get further from that Orange Bowl, from that 10-win season, it's there needs to be some more positives than there are right now. Interesting fact for you, Tom. It was the most points West Virginia has ever allowed in a shutout since Washington and Jefferson in 1914.
Oh, I remember that game.
Washington and Jefferson, a very prestigious university whose football program is no longer competing at the FBS level, I guess.
And oddly enough, it was founded by John Quincy Adams.
Oddly. Now moving on to the other side, the 37-0 shutout had its West Virginia story, but it also had its Maryland story, who has now matched their win total from last year when they were operating with their fourth-string quarterback and almost no offense. And suddenly, Randy Edsall, a head coach that in some circles, at least in these, I would say online, I don't know if this really elevated beyond that, but he brings out some snickers. There's some people who like to make Randy Edsall jokes, and I would like to argue that, and some of this credit does go to Mike Locksley, the offensive coordinator, and Brian Stewart, the defensive coordinator. After Edsall's first season, he gets rid of a lot of the coaches, brings in those guys, and that's really when the turnaround has started. But, where's this Maryland team going? Do you have them as a top 25 team? Because I do, and I've got them ahead of Notre Dame.
Well, the Notre Dame fans are going to love you for that one. No, I have them in the top 25 right now. As far as their staying power goes, I'm not quite convinced yet. I'm not really. I know you've been on this bandwagon for a while. You're wearing your Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle T-shirts, but you got Maryland written across the front instead. But I feel like they got an off week this week, and then they're going on the road to Florida State, and I think that will tell us a lot more than what we've seen in the start. Because the 37 win yesterday isn't something that you should just look past. But at the same time, Maryland offense only averaged 4.6 yards per play. It only had 330 total yards on the day. It really wasn't a fantastic performance. It was West Virginia's 6 turnovers that really did, that really decided this game. So, yes, it's 4-0, and after the last few seasons, 4-0 start is just not something we should just look past. But I think once it gets a bit tougher for Maryland, we might find out just how good this team really is.
I agree with you because they didn't look all that great against Connecticut either.
No. So they're winning, and at the end of the day, that's what counts. But they're not winning convincingly enough for me to sit here and say, oh, yeah, this is a top 25 team.
The reason I think that they are a top 25 team is because I like the sort of different pieces. Even with getting injuries at the cornerback position, there are young players, Will Likely being one of them. Deion Long is a newcomer who's the junior college. I mean, there's a lot of new faces because of a lot of turnover. Like the defense, the defensive side of the ball lost, I think, maybe 6 or 7 starters from last year. And this was sort of the next guys are up, and you didn't really know any of their names coming in. And then you continue to see these strong defensive performances. And so it is a credit to the staff and to them really building and sort of turning things around. And I just think that combined with C.J. Brown, very, very legitimate run, pass, threat. You got Stephon Diggs is an absolute wizard. Deion Long, Brandon Ross. I like the offense a lot.
Yeah, Stephon Diggs is a top 25 player.
Yeah.
I know that. But I think this is a team that's going to finish in that 7-5 area, which, maybe even 8-4, which is compared to how things have been. And for Randy Edsall, I think a 7-5, 8-4 finish would be fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. You got Florida State, Clemson, Virginia Tech. And then just say that there's a Virginia Wake, a game that they should win.
Yeah, I think they could beat Virginia and Wake. That would get them to 6 wins. I think they could beat Boston College at home. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised I wouldn't be surprised if they beat one from Syracuse or stole one from NC State to finish the year. So this is a team that's, I think, is certain to get to 7 wins, possibly 8 with an upset along the way.
Baylor is out here putting up golf scores.
Oh.
And I think Bruce Feldman in his The Big Picture, which really should be a weekly read of yours. I know it is of ours as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, he was just making the point that this is not just a Art Briles system thing. This particular 2013 version of the Bears really is the right combination of talent, both with Lake Seastrunk at the running back position, a really, really good offensive line, And then as Tevin Reese on the outside, you got Petty under center. The way that their offense is sort of set up, the fact that they've got a good offensive line and a good running back really does force the defense to make decisions and leave them open to, like, absolutely getting exploited for these long touchdown plays. Do you think that Baylor's defense has shown you anything yet? That's what you've been holding out on.
Yeah, I'm not convinced yet, but at this point, I don't know that it matters, to be real with you, because, I mean, this defense has been insane, or the offense has been insane. I mean, they're averaging 750 yards per game, and they're averaging 9.84 yards per play. That's damn near a first down per play.
Yeah.
And granted, you know, Wofford, Buffalo, and Louisiana Monroe aren't, you know, amazing, but still, at the moment, right now, Baylor's defense is ranked number one in the Big 12 in yards per play against at only 3.82. That's better than Oklahoma. You know, that's better than everybody else. So I don't know if that's going to last, just because, like I just said, the opponents haven't been fantastic. Although that Louisiana Monroe team is not somebody you should just look past. They just got their butts kicked yesterday.
They beat Wake.
Yeah, they – well, okay. I think you and me and nine of our friends might do pretty well against Wake. But no, this is the defense is improving. I don't know if it's going to be as good as it is right now, but I don't think it needs to be.
Kansas ends a 22-game losing streak against FBS opponents and does so on a Matt Wyman 52-yard game-winning field goal. Louisiana Tech lost two fumbles inside the 5-yard line to help Kansas, to gift wrap this win for Kansas. You want to send any special congratulations to your boy, Charlie Weiss?
Congrats, Chuck. I'm happy that Kansas got this win because, I mean, thinking about that fan base, if you're a fan base of a school that's gone through the times that Kansas has been going through, I don't care how you get the win or who it's against or how ugly. I mean, it just feels good to finally get a damn win. So yeah, to end that losing streak against FBS opponents and finally get it, good for you, Chuck. I'm happy for you. I hope you get some more.
Anything else stand out to you or anything that you are curious to watch moving forward?
Wondering how many more times FIU will call for a running clock.
Call or not call for a running clock. Yeah. FIU coach Ron Turner, as they were getting beat quite badly by Louisville, supposedly he said something about running the ball. Officials thought it was run the clock, and the conferences have reviewed it. There were 5 different times where the clock was running and it should have been stopped. Charlie Strong, I don't know. It's a lot of he said, she said. Seems like it was a bunch of hubbub about nothing because the Panthers weren't going to win anyway.
And I enjoyed all the people that are saying Ron Turner should be fired for that. It's like, come on, man. For showing mercy on his team, he should be fired if he did call for the running clock. Because, I mean, if you think about it, when we're playing NCAA on our, you know, on PlayStation or Xbox, how many times are we Super Simming to the end of games? That's all Ron Turner was trying to
do. He just wanted to hit the Super Sim button.
He wanted to hit the Super Sim, get back to recruiting, and get ready for next week's game. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. It's it is so funny to me how everyone thinks it's their job to talk about whether or not someone else should have theirs.
Yeah, no, I know. It's fantastic. But
he should be fired. It was a clock mismanagement.
As somebody who was in Champaign when Ron Turner was coaching at Illinois and also a Bears fan who's offensive coordinator, I'm more than familiar with the man. And I feel like it's funny that people are saying that are trying to imply that this is Ron Turner's fault for what's going on at FIU, because I think obviously from the decisions we've seen at FIU, from just the decision to fire Mario Cristobal to begin with, but.
And moving forward, just the way the whole coaching search was handled after that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what coach goes into FIU right now and is winning games?
It's a far, far cry from where they were competing for a Sun Belt title like 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, T.Y. Hilton ain't coming through that door, Chip.
T.Y. Hilton is not. All right, be sure to subscribe to the Eye on College Football podcast if you have not. Coming up this week, we've got the return of the Doddcast. Dennis Dodd will check in from Chicago at the site of the latest BCS meetings. I'm sure he will have plenty to talk about, not only this final year of the BCS, but also future as they are determining the selection committee for the college football playoff. Tom, did you submit an application for the selection committee?
No, I did not. I respect myself too damn much.
And after that, Tom will rejoin me along with Jerry Hinnon for the Week 5 preview. We do so by making our expert picks, explaining all the expert picks against the spread for all the top 25 action. For Tom Fornelli, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.